Welcome back to Eschatology Matters. I'm your host, Josh Howard, and I want to remind you, Eschatology Matters is now part of the Fight, Laugh, Feast network, so you can find our content where it's always been, but you can also find it on the PubTV app, or at least I'm told that it'll be there soon if it's not already there. Today is our second installment in a pretty application-based series that we've been doing. We've been calling this Practical Implications of Eschatology, and we're specifically looking at how to establish Christian communities, what that looks like and what that entails, and how eschatology might help inform that discussion. So today I'm joined by a very special guest, Dr. Joe Rigney, coming to us from Moscow. So Dr. Joe, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
So Dr. Rigney, you're a fellow of theology at New St. Andrews. You just had a book come out, Leadership and Emotional Sabotage, which is, I'm assuming it's available everywhere at this point.
It is. It's out in the world.
Out in the world. Fantastic. No, I just wanted to thank you again for the book. The book's been super encouraging. And you want to just give a little plug for the book, by the way, since we're...
Yeah, sure. It's basically, the world's going crazy. The world's falling apart. Great unraveling. Lots of anxiety and angst in the air that kind of crackles through and affects institutions. And therefore, what kind of leaders do you need in order to address that kind of civilizational unraveling? And in it, I'm kind of pulling together some stuff from Edwin Friedman, who was a big influence on me over the last decade or so. But Friedman was, a Jewish rabbi, secular thinker, evolutionist. And so there's a lot of, he's got a lot of great stuff, but you have to kind of wade through a lot of junk. And so I've been using it, but kind of translating it for a while. And this book is kind of the fruit of that, of taking, some of his observations, but trying to ground them and root them a little bit more in biblical soil and say, hey, the Bible actually addresses this and has particular categories. And so to think about what does leadership look like? What's the key virtue is sober-mindedness. How does that, if you try to be that, what's going to happen? You're going to get sabotaged and people are going to have to steer you and take you out. And then what does it look like practically in the home, in the church, in the world? So that's kind of the rug. It's a short book, but hopefully it kind of packs a little bit of a punch and is the sort of book that you need for 2024.
Perfect. Yeah, no, I've shared it around with our leadership here at the church and, with some friends. It's always striking whenever you've got a book like that one where you're describing these scenarios and it's like, oh, I've literally been through that within the last 6 months. Like I know exactly what he's talking about. So you're over the target with it. But let's talk Christian communities a little bit while
Let's do it.
First of all, in your thinking, we're not looking for technical definitions per se, although if you've got one, it's most welcome. But just thinking through with trying to Christian culture build, Christian community build, there's been a lot of pushes lately toward kind of localism or associationalism. I feel like, my limited perspective of especially evangelicalism, there used to be like this whole, especially looking at the nation, looking at wide things. And now there may be a little more of a cultural sense of like, who can I connect to locally? What does it look like to establish things in my home and in my church and in my community? Maybe more so than there were in generations past. But with all that said, like what constitutes a Christian community in your thinking when we talk about trying to build Christian communities? Are there like certain standard features? Obviously, it's going to probably look different in Moscow than it's going to look here in Battle Creek, Michigan, those sort of things. But like what in general can we think about when we think about Christian community?
Yeah. So, well, I mean, as Providence would have it, like I taught on political philosophy for our Lordship students the last couple of days, freshmen. So our freshmen have a theology course that they take. It's like our foundational theology at New St. Andrews. And I teach a couple of cohorts of that or sections of that, and Jared Longshore teaches the others. And so today and yesterday was basically kind of Christian political philosophy. And in the course of that, kind of laying out, that in classic Protestant political thought, politics is the art of associating men together for shared life. So most broadly, politics isn't, we say politics today and we think like elections and Washington, D.C. and things like that. But in the broader tradition, like the historic Christian view, and this goes back to pagan too, Aristotle does it, politics is like anytime you're trying to bring people together for some purpose. So symbiosis is the key word from a guy named Althusius, wrote a book called Politica, which is like a Christianized Aristotle's Politics. And anyway, so it's like associating men together to conserve and preserve and cultivate social life among them. So shared life is what politics is about, which means your household is political, your business, you know, you're at your economic market, if you're a guild, you know, in the old days it would have been a guild or something like that. Today it's a business. So that's political. Church is political. The visible church is a political entity. And the state, the city, your nation, your empire, whatever, all of the different levels of civic society are all political, but everything's political. And some of the key distinctions that they use is basically like, well, you have the inner man. So that's like your soul. And then you got the outer man, your body and your conduct, your public conduct. And while, you know, God has to do with your soul directly, everybody stands before God directly. In the external world, like we have all sorts of relationships of order and structure and hierarchy that we have to deal with. So like in a home, you got father and mother as kind of the heads of that, of a home. Father's the head of the home, and you've got authorities there who mediate God's rule to you in the household. And then you've got the institution of the church, where you have pastors that mediate God's rule in the visible church. And in the state, you've got magistrates who mediate God's rule in society. So in the external world, the external forum, well, that's what Calvin called it, the external forum, you've got mediators in these different kind of core institutions. So the family, the church, and the state. And they're charged with, they're given kind of, they're delegated authority to kind of make rules and enforce rules for the good order of each of those institutions. And so when you think about Christian community, or you think about what that means, that's kind of the, like, that's where you start, is there, you have these bodies of these groups of people, different members of a body that has a head, or in some cases it could be plural heads. You have multiple, you know, elders in a church or something.
Right.
And the right ordering of the body is the responsibility of the heads, who seek to order and structure the body for its purpose, and in obedience to God for the purposes that God set for it. So the family has a particular purpose: be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth. The church has a particular purpose: preach the word, administer the sacraments. The state has a particular purpose: maintain order and justice in society. And each of those different institutions has a purpose. And the task of the head is to regulate and order those entities for their purpose in obedience to God. So that's kind of like a rough and ready kind of how does, and then I think one of the things sometimes that we can do, people will hear that and go, oh, you're talking about sphere sovereignty. You know, like that's how, you know, Abraham Kuyper and those guys talked about sphere sovereignty. And I'm a little bit, sphere sovereignty makes me a little nervous, because it can kind of make it sound like the spheres are autonomous, like they exist under themselves, when the reality is that they overlap a lot, right? Like that your family is affected by your church and by the state, and the state is affected by the family and by the church, and the church is affected by the state and the family. So they kind of overlap, and it's not as though, so there are particular responsibilities that are proper to each one. So, you know, dad doesn't have the sword. He can't execute anybody. That's not his, he doesn't have that authority. Neither can the church. The church can excommunicate, but the church doesn't execute. And so there are different like tools, you know, the family has the rod, as sort of its representative disciplinary tool. The church has the keys, excommunication, that's its representative disciplinary tool, and the state has the sword. So all of that's true, but in terms of the law, the fundamental law that overarches all, it's all God's law, right? Mm-hmm. So the home. So if we take sort of the Ten Commandments as Protestants have historically done, as a shorthand summary of the universal moral law applied to Israel, but like these are universal moral. There's an abiding significance to these laws, in the moral dimension. The family should encourage obedience to all 10 of those in the family, and the church should encourage obedience to all of those in the church, and the state should encourage obedience to all of those in its capacity, using the tools that God has given to it. So everybody's got the same, you know, teach them to observe all that I've commanded you sort of thing that Jesus says in terms of discipleship. Every institution ought to obey God in all of those areas, and they have different means that they've been given in order to accomplish that, in order to direct people to obedience to Christ, obedience to God.
Okay. No, that's super helpful. I appreciate what you said about Kuyper too. That seems like that's a frequent conversation these days, but we won't go down that track. But thinking toward the Christian communities thing. Okay. So you're like, let's just say you're wanting to build Christian community, Christian culture.
Yep.
You're wanting to have that sort of impact where you are. And especially I'm thinking toward like maybe somebody that might be watching this channel, they don't have, you know, they don't hold political office and they don't serve as an officer within the church or anything like that. But like, what are some of those kind of ground level practical steps? Because you just mentioned some universals, right? These are like some of those principles you're talking about are universal. They cross over these different spheres or, you know, whatever we want to call them. But like, what is something that like just the normal pew sitting rank and file Christian, and they're looking around, they're saying, okay, I know this conception. I probably need to start being a good dad in my home or whatever that looks like. But like, what are those like basic steps toward building Christian culture where you are, or Christian community, I'm sorry, where you are?
Yeah, that's good. So I think one thing, so start with this, like worship is at the heart of every community. That'd be a fundamental principle.
Okay.
It's one that we hold to pretty strongly here in Moscow. You know, ancient cities, medieval towns had a cathedral in the town square. Ancient cities had temples at the heart of the city. The New Jerusalem has a temple, you know, well, New Jerusalem doesn't have a temple because the whole thing is a temple, but the temple was at the center of Jerusalem. And so worship, corporate covenantal worship, is at the heart of all communities. And that's true of both believing communities, Christian communities, and unbelieving communities, right? You're going to put something at the center. Worship is going to be the heartbeat. And if you think, that image of heartbeat is helpful because then worship then pumps blood to the rest of the body. It pumps blood into all of the other things. It pumps blood into the family. It pumps blood into the market. It pumps blood into the state. It pumps blood into the arts, entertainment, and society. So that worship is going to, it's going to come out in all of these other areas. So if I'm talking to someone who's going, okay, where do I need to start? It's like, well, you need to start with worship of God, worship of the living God in Christ. That needs to be like, that's the heartbeat. That's the regulatory rhythm in terms of your life. So Sunday morning, worshiping with God's people is fundamental. But then it's going to work its way out and it's going to pump blood. And the first place it's going to land is in your home. So now you're a dad. And if I'm talking to a dad who's the head of his home, and he's the head whether he wants to be or not, open job description for which, you know, it's an indicative, not an imperative. You are the head. Just, are you going to be faithful or not? Recognize that as the head, you're charged with culture making, culture creating. So in your home, you're the cultural guardian, and your wife is your helper in this. And she's actually going to be really, you know, bring a lot to the table in terms of cultivating culture. And culture is going to have two elements. It's going to have a formal element. That's what we call law. So you're going to have house rules. And it's going to have more informal. And this is like the habits of the home. And so there's certain things that are like laws that you're going to say like, okay, there's three rules. Always obey mom and dad all the way, right away with a happy heart. Don't lie. And don't sass your mother. Those are the ones. You have to remember those. You never forget them. If you forget them, you're culpable and you'll get a spanking. That's law. But then there's other things that are more of the informal practices and habits that you're going to have in your home. What do morning routines look like? What do weekly routines look like? And those are also in your purview. Like, you're going to cultivate certain habits, and you're going to do so intentionally or unintentionally. You're going to do so faithfully or unfaithfully. And this is a hard thing sometimes for us to realize, is that like, no, we have this responsibility as the sort of cultural guardians to shape the rhythms of our home, both by rules and by customs, by habits. So I'm saying to a dad, I'm saying, hey, you need to give some thought to these and to think about your rhythms in your life and the communities that then your household then syncs up with. So if worship's pumping blood, it goes to the household. From the household, then you're going to sync up with other households. And that might be through church. It could be through school. Your kid's school. It could be through your workplace, right? You might work with some guys and like you guys, your families do a lot of things together in common enterprise. It could be through sports or other sorts of things like that. But there's going to be these other wider, broader entities that your household is going to connect to. And you're bringing your culture and customs into that in order to shape a broader culture and custom in this larger community now. And again, worship ought to be fueling all of it. And so we're in a Christian school, the worship in the church is going to spill over into the Christian school. If you're playing on a sports team and it's a bunch of non-Christians and you, then you're trying to bring an evangelistic culture into that, right? You're looking for opportunities to model what Christ the beauty of Christ to unbelievers. But you're trying to influence through your own habits and practice and behavior and words, what God is like, and then testify to the gospel. So your household, so from the church, heartbeat, pumps blood to your family, and then your family as a household is then trying to sync up with other communities, other households. They may not even think of themselves as households, but they are, right? That family on the football team is a household that you're then combining together for this purpose, and trying to create a great environment for your kids to play sports.
Right. Okay. No, that's good. And the whole heartbeat. I was trying to just listen to what you were saying because it was so good. But then I was sitting there thinking back to you talking about the three household rules of, you know, obey the rules of this house. You don't lie and you don't disrespect your mother. And now I'm trying to rack my brain with where I stole that from, because I've told my kids that for years.
Yeah.
And now it's very apparent that I stole it from someone.
No. Yeah. We both stole it from Doug, probably.
There you go. Okay. That makes a lot of sense.
And so then I think, from there, you know, you could think about, what the logistics then become a really important question of like the practicals here. And so, one of the things to think about is your use of time and your use of your space, like the various kind of space in terms of like, where you live, that kind of thing.
Okay.
So in terms of time, you got to structure your days, you got to structure your weeks, your months, your years, your seasons of life. And so you're going to take all of that into account to steward your time in a way that's faithful. And then you're going to think about the different sphere. Here's where I do think thinking about overlapping spheres is helpful. So almost all of us in the modern America are going to have a sphere of like our vocation or job. You're going to have a sphere of school, assuming you have children. You're going to have your church, the congregation you're a part of. You probably have some kind of social, you know, extracurricular. That's probably like the sports team, or if your girls are in dance or gymnastics or whatever that sort of stuff is. You know, they're in drama, that kind of thing. And then your neighborhood, like where your home is, where you live. And those each of those spaces is, there's the possibility of community and culture building. And when you put those together, how do you regulate your time and how do you regulate the space? You see how important stewardship is, because you can't do it all.
Right.
And there's going to be limitations. And so that means what? Well, now you're going to have to establish priorities. What are the things that are most important? What's next and next and next? And you've got to, and this is where the seasons comes into play. Like if you're unmarried, priority is like, go find a wife, right? Find a spouse. That if you're unmarried, that rises in importance in terms of your use of stewardship of time. If you have kids, I think about this a lot. I have school age kids. I got a 14-year-old, a 12-year-old, a 5-year-old. Well, this season of life, I say no to lots of stuff because I have a priority of discipling my kids.
Right.
You know, so, you know, here's a practical example. Like I get invited to come speak at places pretty regularly. And I've learned over the years that there are certain times of year I don't want to be gone because it's baseball season or football season, because I want to be present. There's a window of time in which my sons are playing little league or playing high school football, and I want to be there for every bit of it. You know, in 10 years, that season's over, and now I can say yes to more travel because I'm an empty nester maybe at that point or something, you know? And so but my season of life is determining certain priorities for me that stewards my time and where I am, my location, wisely. And so when I think about how do you do it, you need to have that list of what, you know, days, weeks, months, years, and spheres, and then season of life, and pull those together to go, how do we steward this well?
Mm-hmm. So you're already starting to walk into some of what I wanted to get into, which is like the obstacles to doing this whole thing.
Yeah.
You're already mentioning a few of them, obviously time management. And I think a lot of, especially dads, you know, I'm right there with you. My oldest is 14, and I'm already looking back and, you know, evaluating, like, have I used my time wisely? Mm-hmm. Probably not at times. Want to do that better going forward, that sort of thing. But just in general, and I wonder too, you know, speaking to the obstacles, I wonder if it changes things that, you know, there's a lot of talk about, you know, the, you know, Aaron Wren's negative world conception, a lot of the mm-hmm. ways our culture is going. There's kind of those macro level obstacles, but you're also addressing some of the practical level obstacles that are just always there. But in your opinion, what are some of those major obstacles Christians are hitting right now to doing what you're describing?
Yeah, so I would say I'm going to actually give kind of three surprising ones because they're all technological. So I think three unrecognized obstacles to thick community mm-hmm. are the car, the internet, and the smartphone.
Wow.
And you say, well, wow, those are all, aren't those great? Like we can get across the country, we can take our vacation and go across the country and see grandma. And the internet is how we're able to have this conversation right now. And the smartphone is how we keep in touch. And it's like, yeah, they're tremendous blessings. And I'm not saying that, but they also have the potential, there's cost, there's trade-offs. So the effect of the car on our notion of place and the way that it stretches us thin in terms of both our time and where we are. So, because it alters your notion of community. So like 150 years ago, when people said, hey, who's your community? That's basically like, well, walk outside your house and yell as loud as you can. Anybody that can hear you is your community, right? That's right. How far can you walk in 45 minutes? That's your community. Okay. And what that was a limitation, a technological limitation. But what it enabled was a tremendous amount of overlap between the different spheres, right? Your home, where you lived, where you worked, where your kids went to school, where you went to church, were all sort of restrained and restricted by the lack of mobility, right? Mm-hmm. What that meant is there's lots of overlap. Those communities were really dense because the people you work with and the people you go to church with and who your kids go to school with and who they play baseball with and all that is going to be the same group. Well, now you add the car to it, and you're driving 30 minutes in one direction to go to work. You drive 30 minutes in another direction to take the kids to school. You go 30 minutes in another direction to make sure that they can play for that sports team. And now all of a sudden, your notions of space and you're stretched thin because you're spending hours in the car.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, okay. Is that what you want? And you wonder, why doesn't it feel like everything's hanging together? Well, now those different groups, they're different. There's instead of one community that you sort of encounter in different modes. So we see that family at church, we see that family at school, we see that family at work. Instead of encountering that same people in different aspects, it's four different groups of people, right? Often sometimes autonomous, like you never see them at all. This is, I think, especially true for people who live in like urban or suburban environments. It's a little bit different in smaller towns. This has been a realization, you know, sort of in moving from, I was in Minneapolis for 18 years, and now I'm in Moscow. So a city of a couple million to a city of 25,000. And this is probably one of the most significant differences between those two experiences is here, I don't have to choose that. There's certain just things that are given. Like it just is the case that Logos is the school my kids go to. Most of the families go to Christ Church or King's Cross or Trinity. The overlap, you can drive from one end of town to the other in 10 minutes. The overlap of everything is just a given. I don't have to choose it. It's just reality.
Right.
Well, in Minneapolis, to have that same experience required me to make decisions. And it's easy sometimes to let decisions be made sort of for you without a lot of thought so that you end up driving 30 minutes in different directions multiple times a week in order to function. And you feel worn out and spent and you don't know why because you're like, hey, I'm just all, what am I doing? I'm going to church and I'm going to work and I'm going to school. Why does it feel like we're stretched so thin? And it's like, well, because those are three different communities in three different parts of a city. And you've sort of chosen to have them be decondensed, fragmented. And so you feel fragmented. So I think those are the sort of things that like often are unrecognized with families in terms of building community and the basic principle. And so that's car. You could say the same thing about the internet. It fosters connection and community, but it also can lead to kind of like self-selection where you just end up in an echo chamber and therefore you can't function with people who aren't exactly like you.
Mm-hmm.
So like, you know, so the online echo chambers where nobody can even talk to each other because they forgot how, because they're so used to groupthink. And then the smartphone, obviously, is just can be a major distraction. Everybody knows this about the way that it can pull you out of present active community life and you can spend all your time, you can doom scroll, you can, you know, envy scroll. And so you're spending your energy that could be devoted to culture making, culture building, community building, where you actually are present is instead wasted and spent, you know, scrolling online. And so those three things are often unrecognized, what do you call them? Like community sucks, right? They just, right. They suck the life out of a community because you're fragmented by the car. You're isolated by your internet because you're group thinking it and your cell phone's distracting you.
Yeah, no, that's super. Because I'm thinking, you know, you're talking mainly. I mean, mainly you're addressing kind of like family dynamics there, but it applies to the church level too, right? Like we,
For sure.
you know, they've talked about like the commuter church model. You've got the, you know, the mega church on the outskirts, and everybody commutes in from at least 30 minutes. But even I would say like half the pastors I talk to, the church will be 100, 150 people, a small church, right? And yet you've got like eight school districts that are represented. Everybody's kind of scattered, even in small. And then you have this disconnected feeling, which I feel like is so pervasive in our society right now. Everybody, including Christians, feels so disconnected from things. Yeah, that really explains things. So you're suggesting instead to not only be aware of those obstacles, but obviously to try to mitigate those when possible, and kind of
Right.
build
So
that sense of.
the basic principle is something like aim to maximize the overlap of your spheres.
There you go.
Like
Okay.
if you take a principle, it's in terms of setting priorities, given limitations of time and limit and the fact that you're a human being who has a body and you can only be in one place at one time, trying to over maximize the overlap of spheres. Very few of us can do it completely, and I don't even know if that it would be fully desirable if you had complete overlap of all spheres, because it'd probably be insular. But to the degree that you can have overlap between the people you go to church with, the people your kids go to school with, where you live, and who you work with, that's a really good thing. And I'd say it's like right now when I do sort of self-eval my own life, we go to school. Our kids go to school with people we go to church with. We're in a small town, so the neighborhood kind of takes care of itself. I work with a lot of the folks, you know, I work here at NSA, I work at the church. And so there's overlap there. The one place that's kind of the wild card that's sort of its own thing is my boys play baseball for just the school doesn't have a baseball team, and we were a big baseball family. So my son's playing baseball at the public high school, and my oldest son is, and my middle son is playing for a travel team in Pullman. And so those are the two places where we're kind of like outside of our normal community, and we think that's good. Like it's opportunity. You know, we're around non-Christians through that, and there's opportunities there. So that's that. So, but that's something, you know, because we live in a small town, a lot of that is just given. Whereas I think that what people don't realize living in an urban environment or a suburban environment is you're going to have to make intentional choices in order to maximize that overlap. You're going to have to decide, okay, I want to live here because that's close to, and then maybe here's, I'll add this to this. Oftentimes we miss. So I said earlier that the church is the heartbeat of the community, and that's true. It's spiritually, that's the most important. It's the pumps the blood. As a practical matter, logistically, the center of your life, if you're a parent, if you have children, the center of your life for that season is your school. So it's actually, in terms of the logistics, it's more important to live, I think, closer to the school than it is to live closer to your church.
Interesting. Okay. Now I see what
Because
you're getting at.
you know, it's one thing, you know, say driving 30 minutes to go to church on Sunday. Okay, that's not a great, that's a long drive. But would you rather drive once a week 30 minutes on a Sunday morning and then a Sunday afternoon to get to church and back versus every day driving 30 to 45 minutes to get the kids to school, to take them and then to pick them up and to take them
Right.
and to pick them up? Well, now you're talking about, you know, 10 hours, 11 hours, 12 hours more a week getting the kids back and forth. And great, you live next door to the church, which there, hey, you can, it takes 5 minutes to get to the church on Sunday. So as a practical matter, like in terms of stewarding the time that you have, I think living close to your school, because the school will often, for that season of life, when you have school-aged children, will be the central hub of your sort of social life. It's the most common orienting thing, because it's the kids, you got to get the kids there for school, and then usually after school activities, sports, and other extracurriculars are oriented by that as well. So that maximizing that overlap between your where you live and where your kids go to school, I think is actually, I would put that as a higher priority, even if that means you're driving farther to go to the church that you want to go to because that's where the word's preached and that's the culture that you want to cultivate in your home.
Okay. So, I mean, with that in mind, I mean, because we've been talking about Christian communities, but I'm kind of thinking, I don't want to get too far afield, but just like the cultural impact of that, because you're bringing up schools, like this seems like it would be an easy way to suggest Christian education as a viable option If there's not Christian education near you, maybe start investing in that. I mean, that's one of the things Moscow has been famous for, right? Is like the Christian education, especially classical Christian education. Would you see that as kind of part of this dynamic?
100%. So yeah, I should have probably said that more explicitly. So if you're thinking of a body and worship is the heartbeat, corporate worship, church is the heart there, corporate worship is the heartbeat. I would say education is like the skeleton. It's like, it's the backbone. It's the thing that gives structure to it. So that's where, when the Bible says, you know, parents bring your children up, fathers bring your children up in the discipline and instruction of the Lord, the paideia of the Lord. This is an enculturation process. Of both law and custom, of instruction to the mind and shaping of the heart. It's the total immersion in a culture. That's what parents are charged to do for their kids. Well, you can do that. You can homeschool your kids and do that. At one time you might've been able to do it in a public school, but right now, if you were to have your kids in public school, you're effectively saying, well, I'm going to have the state and a godless, hostile state educate my kids. And then I'm going to try to de-educate them when they come home. So you're just doing, the job's getting done twice. It's just enculturate, de-enculturate is what you're choosing to do there. And I know some people are stuck. That's the options they have. Sure. I just think they ought to be trying to prioritize. Yes. Find a way to give your kids a Christian education. That's what they need. And so if that means moving closer to school, if it means homeschooling, whatever that means. So, and with homeschooling, it changes the dynamics since you're doing school at home, but often, you know, at least today, homeschoolers are doing a lot of co-ops, a lot of collaborative things where multiple homeschool families. And so then it's move closer to those families so that there's, again, significant overlap in your spheres. The other thing I'd say about this is, to the degree that it's possible, beginning to see, you know, this is one of the elements. Chris Wiley has written a number of really good things on this about the recovering the productive household.
Yep.
Where you're trying to reorient your view of the household away from the household. The home is where we come to kind of detox. It's a place of consumption where we come home to watch TV and veg out, and instead viewing it as a place of production where the household itself is engaged in some kind of common enterprise, and potentially linking up with other households in common enterprise. So going into business together or whatever you want to call it. And so there's a way which, especially for men, I think this is an important thing. It's energizing to partner with like-minded brothers in order to do some common enterprise, whatever the business is, construction business, or if you're a lawyer going into law, you know, starting a firm or whatever your sphere, a plumbing company, whatever it is, like common vocation with other folks who are like-minded is both energizing and is a part of like community building.
Right.
And it's especially important, I think, as we enter, you mentioned negative world a little bit ago, Aaron Wren's notion there. And I've said probably for the last 10 years, even before this was, even before the negative world really manifested itself, that in the present day and for the foreseeable future, one of the most loving things that you can do for your Christian brother is to provide a work environment where he can pull a paycheck and not have to lie.
Wow. Yeah.
Right. Like, in other words, so he can live in the truth and doesn't have the constant specter of, okay, if they ask me to fly the rainbow flag, am I going to quit?
Right.
I feel like I have to quit, but then how am I going to provide for my family? Like that anxiety and that angst that hangs over a lot of guys because they're in an environment that's hostile to their faith and they're always trying to thread all the needles lest they set off the Wokies and the Rainbow Brigade. So what would be an act of love to that guy? Well, having a business, having a company where that guy can work and he can just be a faithful Christian. It doesn't mean that only Christians work there, but it means that the norms and the structures and the values of the company are Christian. And so that he's welcome to be there. You could have a non-Christian work there. He can evangelize them. That's great. But the point is he can be himself. He can be a faithful Christian and not have to worry about providing for his family.
Yep.
That's an act of love. And so entrepreneurship in the present environment, common enterprise. And again, that's what does that create? That's a possibility of overlapping spheres. If you start a business and you've got a couple of guys whose kids go to the same school and you guys are a part of the same church, that provides multiple touch points where you're going to be around people that allows for a thickness of community that I think all of us are craving and finding very difficult in the modern technological fragmented world.
Yeah, no, that's super helpful. And the business thing, I think, is so, if anybody's ever seen and been around that sort of environment where you have just a Christian employer, again, like you said, you're not signing a statement of faith when you join the job, but everybody knows what the business is and everybody knows what the values are. Just that sense of that sense of peace that can bring. We have, you know, I pastor a smallish church, and it's almost a weekly conversation with somebody about their employer and something coming down the pike that they're going to have to wrestle with morally. Any thoughts, Dr. Rigney, on anything we've covered, any kind of, like, you know, closing, maybe even resources to point somebody to, or something like that concerning Christian communities?
Yeah, I think the other thing that I'll have is, a number of things that I'm talking about here. I'll be out in Utah with the Ogden guys in June. You know, they got a conference on building Christian boroughs or something like that. Yep. So it's a similar kind of deal. So some of what I'm saying here is kind of like the rough cut of what will be there. So if you're interested and you want to come out to that conference in June, you'll get a little bit more. I think the only other thing maybe at this point that I'd say is recognizing the importance of stability. This is, again, where that mobility question is a kind of disruptor. The ease with which we can move houses, move neighborhoods, move cities. I mean, I just made a big move about 8 months ago, and I'm thinking about this because, you know, it uprooted our family. We moved them across the country, and it was, I think, faithful. It was the right decision, all things considered. But a highly mobile society sort of militates against the cultivation of customs and tradition.
Yep.
And those are actually really important. We crave them, we want them, and they're harder to maintain and sustain if you got people who are constantly coming and going. Now, there's no way, I don't think we can put that genie back in the bottle. That's just part of the world we live in. But to the degree that we can try to have a kind of stability, you plant roots and you try to really say, this is where we are, and we want to grow, we want to build here. That, I think, enables a shared way of life. Because we feel like I don't have a way of life. It's just kind of all deracinated, decontextualized. It's modern pop culture rootlessness. And instead, what I think a lot of people want is something sturdier, deeper, that has deep roots, where you build something that you can hand on to your kids, and then they can hand on to their grandkids and generationally. And customs and traditions like that require stable communities.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing maybe to say about that kind of idea of custom is, this is, I think, why in the present moment, a lot of times, you know, I'd say probably, you know, 20 years ago when I was in college, the question of, like, picking a church often centered first about kind of doctrine. At least that, you know, so I think some people were like, oh, do they like the kids program or something? I was in college, so I didn't care about that. But it was like, you know, theologically, where are they? What's their statement of faith? And I think now a lot of what people are actually looking for more is this the kind of community that's going to reinforce the kind of culture that we want in our home? Because we feel the hostility of negative world around us and know that, like, we can't, like, I want to guard my family, but there's just so many entry points that the world has in terms of media and technology and just the toxicity of the world. And it's like, I want to be able to have my kids in a place where other families are going to reinforce the values, customs, and practices, habits that I want to instill in my kids.
Right.
And so in some ways, shared culture and cultural affinity is an even, I think, stronger draw for people. And that enables them to overlook even theological differences that 20 years ago might have really mattered. So this, I'm thinking about people who, if there's a shared culture there, we can get past the baptism, paedo-baptism thing. We can get past eschatology thing. We can get past the spiritual, you know, gifts of the spirit sort of discussions. We might even be able to get it past some of the sovereignty of God, Calvinism, Arminianism stuff. Those things, in some ways, I can tolerate a lot of differences at those levels if there's a really thick shared community that I'm trying to raise my kids in. And I think that's probably wise and good. To prioritize that. That's not to deprioritize some of those important theological questions, but it's to say that in an environment where you want to raise your kids to love Christ, you can, if it's much harder if everybody agrees on paper that God is sovereign in salvation, but you've got one family that has a lot of worldliness coming in because they're in the public school, another family that has a very weird view of how to discipline kids, and you've got a bunch of fragmentation in terms of how you actually build culture, that's actually a harder environment to navigate than it is someone who we're all synced up on raising our kids, Christian education, but we do have some differences on these theological secondary matters. Right. I think that makes sense in negative world.
Right. No, that's that seems to be panning out. And I think that's one reason why you see a lot of churches seemingly making some pointed efforts toward mitigating some of those theological distinctions. Again, not to say that they're not important, not to grapple with those things, and yet not to make those dividing lines that divide Christian communities up. No, super helpful. Appreciate you joining me today. Everybody go out and buy Leadership and Emotional Sabotage, although we didn't talk much about the book on here, but it's a great book. But Dr. Joe, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Seated here at my right.